From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. When Emma Thompson heard that Skydance Animation hired John Lasseter despite sexual misconduct allegations, she dropped out of a project with the studio. Then she wrote a letter.
If a man has been touching women inappropriately for decades, why would a woman want to work for him if the only reason he's not touching them inappropriately now is that it says in his contract that he must behave professionally?
Emma Thompson on why she wrote those words and what she wants to happen next. Plus, could screenwriters be about to fire their agents? All that and more coming up on The Frame. So the clock is ticking on a midnight deadline for contract negotiations between screenwriters and their talent agents. The dispute is about power and money in a changing TV business, and there are a couple of big sticking points for both sides, so-called packaging fees and the fact that a couple of the biggest agencies in town, WME and CAA, are now producing and financing content. All this is possibly leading to the eye-catching headline that writers could fire their agents. And you know what? It might happen. Cynthia Littleton is business editor for Variety. She's been covering the contentious negotiations. I reached her by phone today to talk about the latest developments.
Well, they've spent the past 5 days in communication to a degree that they hadn't been in the months leading up to the previous April 6th deadline. But I have to say, although they've been in communication, they've exchanged proposals, the last I was hearing, it does not look good for a deal. They seem to be very far apart on the key issues.
So what happens if they can't come to an agreement? Writers start making their own deals. I mean, I can't quite picture talent agents out on the street looking for work. But what is the scenario? What are the possible outcomes if they can't figure out a resolution?
It's really interesting because this kind of dynamic, we just really haven't seen this before. On the agency side, there are, you know, promises that it will lead to chaos and great disruption in the normal course of business. And there's already a lot of disruption in Hollywood right now. So there's a feeling like, you know, why are we adding this to the mix right now? And there are other feelings that the agent's classic agent's role is the matchmaker for the client and the employer. And there's a feeling that maybe in this, you know, wired and easily connected age, that maybe some of those functions can easily be handled through social media connections, through the connections that we all now organically make so easily through digital means. The truth probably lies somewhere in between, something less than total chaos, but something less than the ease with which Hollywood writers are getting work these days, because if you haven't noticed, there's a lot of television out there. There's a lot of content being made, and all of that requires writers.
I want to look at a couple of the key issues. There seem to be two fundamental areas of dispute. One involves so-called packaging fees, and the other is about some of the bigger agencies starting to produce content on their own. So let's start with packaging fees. The writers would argue that's money that's coming right out of the production. It isn't really tied to any kind of agenting work. And they can obviously be a lot more lucrative than the typical 10% that a talent agent would collect from his or her client. And that leads us to the second big dispute. And that is that some of the biggest agencies, including the Creative Artists Agency and William Morris Endeavor, have started producing their own content. And the Writers Guild argument, as I understand it, is it's very tricky for a company like a talent agency to be both the employer and represent the employees. And that comes to, I think, the overarching concern around all of this, and that's what's called a fiduciary duty. And the writers would say the agents have a fiduciary duty, an obligation to do what is in the best interest of their clients, the writers, above anything else.
And I think the response on the agency side would be like, you know, last time we checked, we didn't have to clear our business practices with the Writers Guild of America. But the Writers Guild, for decades, has had the ability to what they call franchise agents. Basically, the Writers Guild, as the union representative of writers, has the authority to decide the terms of engagement for talent agents that want to represent its members. It's very much a power play between who has the authority to, no holds barred, make decisions on who can represent writer clients and how. It's really, there's a real tug of war and a lot of resentment that the Writers Guild has, you know, has just kind of opened up this, opened the tent here on practices which, to be fair to the agents, these have been going on for decades, and it's been, I think it's been jarring for a lot of people in the talent representation field to hear packaging and packaging fees described as criminal and immoral and illegal. And there's a feeling that, like, all of a sudden it's been whiplash. You know, 3 months ago, nobody was talking about this. All of a sudden it's immoral and illegal. And, it, you know, that's made for very difficult conditions to negotiate.
If the Writers Guild and the talent agents are unable to reach a deal in the next 24 hours, or if they extend through the weekend, does that mean that your favorite TV show will go away in a couple of weeks? The next Fast and the Furious movie won't come to theaters? Will there be a consequence in the very short term of anything remotely like that?
No, because this is not a labor action per se. It's not like writers won't go to work on Saturday or Monday. This is a much more inside baseball fight. For the most part, it's fair to say that the traditional Hollywood source of profits are really shrinking for all the constituencies in the industry, even the big studios, and even most workaday writers are not finding the same kind of home run hits that you could have 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that would churn out the big syndication dollars. Now there's more TV than ever, and we're seeing in the entertainment industry these enormous headlines of writers getting these huge $100 million, $150, $200 million deals, and they're eye-popping. But that's very much, it reflects the, you know, the debate over in the income gap across the country. That's very much an elite A-list. Everybody else, the vast middle and the lower rung people, are really getting squeezed, and it's harder to make the same kind of good living that you did 10 years ago. This is just another example of people dealing with an industry that is truly in the throes of transformation.
Cynthia Littleton is the business editor at Variety. Cynthia, thanks so much for coming on the show. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, John.
Coming up, Emma Thompson wrote a letter, and it was a very big deal. Emma Thompson has several movies coming out this year, but she made the most news recently when she dropped out of a film. Thompson was slated for a voice role in the upcoming animated movie Luck, but she left the project when Skydance Animation, their production company making the movie, brought on John Lasseter, the disgraced former head of Pixar Animation Studios. Lasseter had been removed from Pixar and the Walt Disney Company for allegations of sexual misconduct. Skydance chief David Ellison didn't seem to grasp how his hiring of Lasseter would play out, but other people did. LA Times columnist Mary McNamara summed it up pretty well when she spoke with The Frame back in February.
David Ellison sent a really long, and it was a little like defiant email, basically saying, "We've talked to John and he understands that some things that he has done in the past were not appropriate. He has, you know, been addressing those issues, and it is in his contract that he must behave professionally. So nobody should be worried." I mean, the absurdity of like someone being hired at this level of, oversight, overseeing this huge staff for, I'm sure a lot of money, and having to, his boss having to point out that he is contractually obligated to behave professionally is just, I mean, my hair just like went on fire.
Emma Thompson didn't just drop out of the Skydance movie. She also wrote a powerful letter calling out the company for hiring Lasseter. Then she gave that letter to Mary McNamara, who published it in the LA Times. Emma was in Los Angeles this week to talk about her summer movie Late Night, but we also discussed her confrontation with Skydance and what needs to happen next. Before we get to that, the veteran actress and screenwriter shares what she thinks makes for a really great film.
You know, it's got to be a life-changing experience. In some way or other, you've got to come out feeling different. And in my view, our job is to uplift. I really do think that's what we're here for. And so when I've walked out of the cinema feeling uplifted, truly uplifted, then I know I've seen a good movie. And that doesn't happen very often. I often compare it, actually, to... It needs to be the same for the theatre, but I compare it to when how I felt when I came out of Superman, the first Superman movie, when I was very young. But I just remember feeling so warmed, uplifted, and as though I could fly. So I kind of look for that feeling again and again and again. And you don't get it very often. But then you don't get it very often in the theatre either, because good art is hard. And actually, there's no reason not to continue to go to see art that isn't quite that good, because at some point or other, you'll come across something that's great. But it is a very good reason to subsidise and get behind people who are trying to create art and support people who are struggling. And so I do that too.
I want to ask you about a movie that you chose not to make. And this is the animated film Luck. That was at Skydance, which is David Ellison's company, animation company at Paramount. And you decided not to make it because Skydance had hired John Lasseter, who'd been fired from Pixar for the way that he'd treated women. And you wrote a letter that I have described on the air as the Magna Carta of the Me Too movement. It's one of the most beautiful, eloquent, and well-argued letters about this whole notion of the way women are treated, the way the men are forgiven, that I found profound. And I want to ask you two things about it. What motivated you to write it, and what gave you the ability to write it?
Very good questions. I think I just left the production, and then I wrote to Lindsay Duran about it. And Lindsay's one of the most brilliant women I know. I said, Phil, can you talk to some women about this? I'd really be interested to know what's going on. And in fact, that letter is the work of many voices. It's not just my voice, because those questions very much came from those women. So that's what's so wonderful about it, is that it is a collective voice. And I sent it to Skydance and didn't receive a reply. And because I'd shared it with quite a lot of people, because of the issue being very pressing, a lot of them just said, you've got to publish it. And that was quite a big decision, because it's just a bit public. But the decision, it turned out to be the right one, because those were the questions that needed to be asked, and to this date have not been answered in any way. I've had no response, public or personal, back from Skydance. Perhaps because they don't have a good response, they don't have any answers to those questions, and therefore they've just decided not to respond. And that's very disappointing, because the only way we're going to get anywhere with this ongoing issue is by talking to each other.
It's not just a public thing to do. It's a thing that potentially, and this is what has happened over the last couple of decades that has kept women silent, is they fear that they will be punished, that they will be blackballed, they won't get parts, that people will
treat
them.
Well, and they're right. They're absolutely right.
So why were you able to do it? What gave you that opportunity? Because a lot of other women would say, I feel this way, but I know that if I say these things, something bad might happen to me.
I'm 60.
Not yet. You have a birthday coming up.
I'm 60. I'm far too old not to walk my own talk. Time is very much marching on. And because I had spoken up before, when the Weinstein thing blew up, and I've always spoken up about this since I was a young woman, there was absolutely no choice, really. And what was interesting to me and very touching was the responses I got from so many people, male and female, who had done the same thing, who had walked away and who perhaps don't feel as established as I feel. You know, I can do other things. It's not going to kill my career, even if Skydance says, right, we're never going to work with you again and we're going to tell every other animation not to work. But I don't think that that would be possible now, because I do feel that with the Me Too Time's Up movement, there is a tipping point. But we do have to keep on. And one of the ways in which I think we're going to have to do that is we've got to talk to people before, during and after film shoots. It's got to be a practical thing that happens on a daily basis while we're actually doing the work. Because, we've had a lot of historical stuff. For instance, one of the things I did recently, which was incredibly helpful to me, was I got a lot of the young women who'd worked on Last Christmas together for an informal meeting about what it had been like to shoot that film and how comfortable they'd been and whether they'd had any moments of discomfort. And of course, they had. And I didn't know about
what kinds
them.
Of things.
They just had had experiences with some people on our crew that had made them uncomfortable, and they'd been bullied from time to time. And it, of course, it happens. The clever thing about anybody who's going to bully is that they'll do it not in front of someone who's going to say, you can't do that. They'll do it in secret or in quiet or in private. And it's very difficult, for instance, for someone who's a runner and who can be replaced in 5 minutes to say anything bad about someone who it will cost a lot of money to replace. And all of these things, they have implications for everyone. So I want to learn more about that by talking to people before, during and after a film shoot. It's very practical. And I would also say that studios that are now doing this sort of harassment week, this is just not working, you people. It's not working. No one's taking it seriously. And actually, because it's in public, folk don't feel able or free to speak. You've got to make a safe space. That's particularly important for women, and it's particularly important for young women who are just starting in the business. You have to make a safe space. And I would recommend to all women who are in positions of power, who are producers, who are line producers, to create those safe spaces where young women can come and feel as though they're not going to jeopardize their jobs by having a conversation. It's no good having a town hall conversation saying, hey, this is your boss. Just say whatever you like. I mean, that's insane.
I'm going to ask you a favor right now. And this is not part of your letter that's specific to Skydancer John Lasseter. I'm asking you to read two paragraphs from it because I think it's something that everybody needs to hear. And I hope you would share these two paragraphs with us right now.
If a man has been touching women inappropriately for decades, why would a woman want to work for him if the only reason he's not touching them inappropriately now is that it says in his contract that he must behave professionally? If a man has made women at his companies feel undervalued and disrespected for decades, why should the woman at his new company think that any respect he shows them is anything other than an act that he's required to perform by his coach, his therapist, and his employment agreement? The message seems to be, I am learning to feel respect for women, so please be patient while I work on it. It's not easy.
Emma Thompson, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Emma Thompson co-stars with Mindy Kaling in the upcoming comedy Late Night. It's in theaters June 7th. We'll bring you more of our conversation with Emma Thompson on making that film in the weeks to come. Up next on The Frame, would a plush reclining seat with lumbar support make your movie-going experience just a little better? Last week, I traveled to Las Vegas to attend CinemaCon. It's the annual convention for movie theater owners who see tons of clips of upcoming movies. But there's something else that's being sold at CinemaCon. Inside two big convention halls, scores of vendors are selling theater owners things like new concession snacks, high-tech video games for theater lobbies, and the latest in super plush stadium seating. Peter Goldstein works at a company called Octane Seating, and he explained to me the appeal for theater owners to upgrade to some of his luxurious recliners.
One of the things when these types of chairs first came out was that they're a lot bigger, they're a lot bulkier, so it's going to take up more space in the theater. So at first they're a little bit apprehensive of that, thinking, okay, I'm not going to make as much money. But what they found is they're able to charge a premium ticket price because they're giving their customers a premium experience. So what's happening is they're actually increasing their ticket prices, which is driving more revenue, which is driving more profitability. And plus, it's an experience. Now they come to the theater, and it's memorable, and they're going to come back, and they're going to get a lot more repeat customers.
So tell me about your models. What am I sitting in now? I'm sure they have some fancy name, the RX 2000. What is this thing?
Actually, that's pretty close. It's the Turbo XL 700.
So what is this? What does this seat do? It's a love seat. We have. It looks like the back seat of a Mercedes Sprinter van. It's super comfortable.
This one's part of our signature series, and what it comes standard with power recline. It comes with a USB port on the power switch. If you look there on your left, so you can charge your electronics while you're watching your show.
I want to make this clear. You can charge your electronics, but not use your electronics, right? It almost seems like you're encouraging people to be on their phones in a movie theater.
You know, it's just one of those accessories where it depends on the theater owner, I guess. Yes.
Okay, so I can charge my phone that I'm not going to use. What else does it do?
Yeah, so we've got three collections. We've got our signature series, which comes standard with power recline. Our next series has, in addition to that, power headrest. But then our third series has also lower to mid lumbar support as well with a button. So you can push it just like you're in a car. And it actually gives you that lower lumbar support, which is very important for people who have, you know, maybe stress in their backs, and it relieves any muscle fatigue.
Those seats are so comfortable that if you're in a bad movie, you could sleep very comfortably right through it. Even though last year was a pretty good year at the box office, the actual number of tickets sold at theaters isn't growing, and it hasn't been for a while. So theater owners have to fight to make sure movie fans keep coming to the multiplex. Premium seating might be one draw. Another could be eSports. There's a company at CinemaCon called My Cinema, and they were giving guests a chance to try out the company's Racer X Club.
So what am I driving here? It doesn't look like my Honda hybrid.
No, far from it. It's a Formula Renault 3.5 liter, also somewhat like a F3 car or the second division in Formula One.
Okay.
All right, grab the wheel. As soon as you give it gas, it'll put it in gear and you're underway.
Just trying to get the feel of the car. That was a little crash. I didn't brake well. I can't get back on the road. There we go. Am I going the right way now? I mean, even though this is like a virtual race, I'm like sweating. It's so intense. So in theory, would I be racing people at other theaters, people
yes.
sitting next to me?
Yes.
And how many people could be in a race?
I've seen as many as 60, 70 cars on the track at one time.
And the idea is you would install these in a movie theater lobby, so before or after the show, or just come out and race before the show starts?
Exactly. And Lobby A in Tucson, Arizona could race against Lobby B in Chicago, Illinois.
Glenn Morton of My Cinema says the idea about bringing esports attractions like this to a movie theater is to get people to come back to the theater more often and actually stick around for longer periods of time.
With this type of event cinema, is what we would call the esports, you come in on race day, you get to watch your team race. But we also bring in NASCAR or Formula One or some other content, and it becomes a day. It's a day long that they stay in there.
And what are exhibitors saying? I mean, what is your pitch to them, and what kind of sense are you getting from them about the feasibility of installation?
You know, this is probably the easiest thing I've ever sold in my life. The traffic is nonstop. They love it. They get it. They especially get the idea of esports and bringing people back again and again, because they're clearly looking for ways to make it a entertainment venue again. There's less and less opportunity with the blockbusters. You look at Q1 was really not that good for the industry. 2020 is not looking much better. So this is everything we're hearing is this is absolutely what's needed.
Finally, one of the pleasures of any streaming service is you can basically watch whatever you want to watch when you want to watch it. If you want to catch a movie in a theater, though, your choices are usually limited to just the newest releases playing at a prescribed time. In some ways, it's kind of like an old-fashioned bus schedule. If you want to get somewhere, you show up when the bus does. But what if movie theaters started using a movie-going equivalent of Lyft and Uber? GoGo Cinema is trying to do just that with a new on-demand app for the multiplex. Let's say you want to celebrate your birthday by booking a theater for a private screening of Saturday Night Fever. Or you want to go see Jordan Peele's Us, but at 10 in the morning at a theater not currently showing it. If you can organize a big enough group for both screenings through the GoGo Cinema app, then you can see the movie that you want where and when you want to see it.
So today, in every aspect of a life or business, as consumers, what we want is we want choice, we want convenience, we want customization.
Prasad Kedekar is with GDC Technology Limited. They're the parent company of GoGo Cinema.
Unfortunately, this business of cinema has continued the same way for decades now, and it's up for disruption, and we feel we can do that. We're working within the ecosystem. There's a value to be created for everyone, and we want to create that. So that's an objective of GoGo Cinema, is get Uber-like platform to the cinema industry.
Prasad, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And that is it for the week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, Julia Paskin, and Andrea Gutierrez. Our intern is Paul Ratliff, and our engineer is Valentina Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.